Hi, everybody. This is Christopher. Welcome to Finding Japan, episode 36, I think. Well, I just wanted to thank everybody for tuning in yet again. I was just talking to Alex here and saying about how I think podcasting is just getting way too complicated as of late. You should see the insane kind of setup we have going on right here right now. We have quite a few mics set up. Actually, not quite a few. I'm talking into my laptop, and Alex is on the other side of the room with another mic. And Alex is here, of course, to talk about Mount Fuji, which I did say that I would eventually get to. And I know it's taken a while. I think it's been, what, maybe like a month almost since we've been to Mount Fuji?
Yeah.
It had to be about a month, right?
You went up, I think, the first weekend, right?
Yeah, the first weekend that Linda was here.
Yeah.
I went up. And I think that had to be, that was the end of July.
Yeah.
At the end of July. And when did you go up?
We went up, I think, was it 2 weeks after?
2 weeks after?
Yeah. Just about.
Okay. Well, I think during that period of time, there probably wasn't much difference.
No, I'd say weather-wise, crowd-wise, it was still during the peak climb season. So.
Yeah. There's only, for those of you who don't know, there's only a few, I don't know, maybe it's about two and a half, maybe 3 months worth of actual climbing time when it's fairly reasonable to climb Mount Fuji.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the pictures, I think, that people have seen of Mount Fuji show, you know, the mountain with the snow on the top.
Right, yeah.
And when we climbed, there was barely any snow at all. I think maybe some patches of snow along the sides there. But according to the Japan guide here, July and August are the official climbing season. So I guess maybe a month on either side of those, half a month. And then you have to, bust out some hardcore rock climbing gear to get up that thing. Okay, we didn't really come up with a fancy-dancy outline here to talk about Mount Fuji. In fact, we're kind of disorganized. We had a plan to go check out Transformers at the movie theater, but why don't we actually talk about that for a second,
actually,
too?
Because
that is kind of interesting here, and we'll get to the Mount Fuji stuff in 1 second, but stick with us here. This has got to be a really strange experience for Alex because I have a set of headphones on here, so I'm hearing all the bumper music and he's just sitting in the corner.
Yeah, I'm kind of looking at you for like cues.
Yeah. Well, don't look at me for cues. I don't know what I'm doing. No, we went to Asakusa today.
Right.
And we went to go look for a movie theater. Apparently, I searched on the internet for movie theaters in Asakusa, and there's a fairly well-known street, apparently. It's been there for quite a few years in terms of, like, it's been set up for entertainment. Like, the entertainment area.
Yeah, that's Shitamachi, right?
Shitamachi? Is that what it's called?
I think so.
I'm not sure, but I'll take your word for it. There's two movie theaters there, so looking on the map, we kind of thought, oh, well, one of them has to have it. And we took our time getting there, grabbed some lunch, and then headed over to the movie theaters, and what did we find there?
The first one was showing Western movies.
Western movies.
Western, but they were still pretty old. I was surprised because I saw like a picture of Arnold, like Collateral Damage, which was, I don't know how old that movie is. I've never watched it, but
I don't think I've ever seen that movie. But I do remember, it's got to be at least, 4 years old?
If more than that, I think.
Yeah. The posters that were on the outside of this place were pretty interesting. They're like they almost look like they were, somebody took a photograph and then drew or like painted ink over them, sort of inked them in like a cartoon. Remind me of those old I think they were in the 50s, those like love, those like dirty novels.
Mm-hmm.
But they had like, you know, like high school tramp, you know, but it was all illustrated like the front of it. It kind of reminded me of that. Yeah, one theater had a bunch of old movies. Right.
I didn't think that was too strange either, because you know some theaters back home still show like old, you know, older films.
Yeah. Well, I think even in the U.S. now, it's more like the DVD or no, the it comes out in a theater, then a month later it's on DVD.
Yeah.
And then usually like the universities get them for like the local theaters, mm-hmm. and then there's those strange theaters that always play the really strange movies that you haven't seen, like, you know, The Last Starfighter or something.
Yeah.
But and then there was another theater right next door.
Yeah.
And this theater was a trip. On one side, it had all of these classic Japanese movies. I didn't recognize any of the titles, but I recognized sort of the period they were from. And I think they were from probably the 20s and the 30s.
Yeah, definitely pre-war. Early. Yeah, pre-war.
Pre-war. But right next to it, on the building, right under the marquee there, that open lobby area, there was these advertisements for these women, these, like, I don't know, I guess they're pornos, to put it lightly.
Yeah, I'd say they are.
And they had posters of these movies,
right,
as if they were on the actual box of the movie. They had no censorship, no black bars, no anything. You could pretty much see everything.
Yeah, and it's just right and open.
Right, yeah. Open.
Not
right
trying to hide it.
Not
in any
trying
way
to hide it. What do you think the older people think about that, especially with, you know, lots of kids running around in socks off?
I don't know, because the two guys that are going in were older guys.
They were, yeah. Looked like they were retired, yeah, and nothing there to do than drink beer. Which I hope I get to sometime soon.
It's not a strange thing though, because I saw another theater in Ueno on my way to Ueno Park, and it's quite similar. They just had the posters right out there and open. So
but that theater was actually like a porno theater.
Yeah, it was
specifically.
Which is strange, because you know, in like convenience stores, they segment off the section for certain magazines.
Right. They usually put a little plastic divider.
Yeah, exactly.
Which sticks out maybe, 6 inches from the rack.
Mm-hmm.
It's nothing big. Yeah.
Right. But they do, you know, try to section it off from kids, I suppose.
Well, I guess this theater had, you know, it had the entrance, and on the left side there was the old movies.
Right, the oldies.
What do you call it?
The classics.
The classics.
Yeah.
And on the right side, there was the classics.
Classic. Exactly.
I was telling Alex, we said, it's like going to a theater, and on one side of the theater, they're playing Gone with the Wind, and on the other side, they're playing Debbie Does Dallas.
Yeah.
It was incredible. So, yeah, if you're ever in the Asakusa area, go to, I think it's the Rocks building area, and just walk that street up north, and the two theaters are on the left there, and you'll see what I mean. There's a bunch of really crowded today pachinko parlors. Yeah, have you ever played pachinko before?
I went in with a few friends when I was working. I mean, it's not too bad when just like a group of guys, and we're just like kind of laughing at this one dude who's losing all his money. But like most guys who go in there go by themselves.
Yeah.
Just sit there for hours.
I think one of the reasons why there's so many machines is because people don't want to sit next to each other.
It's probably true. I mean, it's so loud anyways. You really can't have a conversation.
Yeah. Yeah. I always wonder how long those guys that have maybe 4 or 5 baskets of balls have been sitting there.
Well, I know like each time you put in a few, but it can't be more than 10. So it must take forever for them to go through all those.
They probably have a card where you can put all your balls back on the card and then leave and then come back and take them all off again. I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, they do that.
Machine,
yeah.
But in reverse. Okay, so there you have it. That is a little bit about, I almost said vending machines, but no, movie theaters in Asakusa. Okay, that was a little distraction there, but beyond that, we're back to Mount Fuji.
Right.
Oh, there's a song. That's the
most, pretty cool.
That's the most ridiculous thing.
It is like for half a minute at least.
We we're never gonna get this Fuji episode done.
I know.
We have to tell the story about the washer.
The washer?
Yeah.
I don't know why not.
Why don't you start?
About our new one?
Well, no, just the whole history of the washing machine since we've been here.
Well, we first started out renting a washer-dryer combo. Do you know what brand it was?
I did. I forgot.
But anyways, the issue was that whenever it went to the drying phase, it would just rattle like crazy. I don't know if it's just unbalanced or what. But we had some guys come in and look at it. And they stuck like some pads underneath, but that really didn't help. So it was driving us pretty crazy. Actually, I was more worried about the neighbors than us.
Yeah.
With the just bumping and grinding, basically.
We tried everything to try and fix this thing, including like trying to tighten up the things in the back and sitting on it when it was going real fast, and nothing just seemed to work. And after a little while there, we ended up just not running it through the spin cycle and going right to the dry cycle.
Yeah, so we'd have to dry it for at least 3 hours.
Yeah.
We'd have to go for the 3 hour drying cycle, and that even then, you know, the clothes would come out a little steamy, actually. Yeah. Is the best way to put it.
The technique for drying the clothes ended up, or for doing a load of laundry ended up being, okay, so you put the clothes in and you start the wash cycle, and then you let it get through the first part of the wash, or the rinsing part of the rinse cycle, but it would try to spin a little bit and that would just be out of control, so you'd have to stop, but there'd still be some soap in the clothes.
Right.
So the next step was to rerun the rinse cycle and try to let it spin as much water out as you could, completely skip the spin cycle, and go right to the dry. But with the dry, like you said, it would come out hot and steamy. So I found maybe let it dry for an hour, and then open it up and let all the steam
out. You'd have to leave the little door open for an hour or so.
Yeah. So it was a very needy
process. Yeah, it's a long process.
But now we finally had a new washer delivered, and it seems to be working pretty good, but it plays these incredible tones when you start it, and when it finishes, it has a good, like, I don't know, maybe 15 to 20 second song that it plays for you, just to let you know that your laundry's done, because a single beep is apparently not sufficient for the Japanese market.
Like, the one back home just gives you a really loud buzz. It's really rude, you know?
Yeah. And the other strange thing with this washer, though, is that it has some sort of air dry function.
Yeah, I haven't figured it out yet.
We haven't figured it out, but we probably should figure that out since I've come up with what I call a clothes mobile in order to dry my clothes, which is a contraption of hangers off of hangers in order to actually do a single load of drying laundry. But unfortunately, it looks as though it really wrinkles the clothes up. So
yeah, you're gonna have to iron your
t-shirts.
Yeah.
So that's sort of our saga with the washer, and it's been what, about four and a half months?
Yeah,
we've been dealing with that.
5 months basically.
Yeah. Okay.
That's pretty cool that we didn't charge us for it though.
Yeah, that actually Tokyo Rent, that I think I spoke about them before on the podcast, were really, really cool about it, and like Alex said, they backed out all of the charges up from when we started, and now reduced our charge too because we only have just the washer apparently. But if we can figure out how to get that air dryer working, then it's a much better deal. We'll pretty much raise our laundry per dollar ratio, whatever you want to call it. Okay, all right. Let's actually talk about Fuji.
Let's get more Fuji now.
That's been 15 minutes.
Wow.
Already. Think about all the time we'll spend on Mount Fuji.
Yeah. We didn't even talk about Royal Host either, but
no, we're gonna have to save that. My whole experience with Royal Host has been a saga. Now I feel like I've been set free.
Yeah.
I know that there's one within 10 minutes of us here. Okay, and I'm also drinking Mitsuya cider again. We had a nice conversation about the
about the vending machine.
About the Mitsuya cider vending machine. But wow, there's so many topics.
I know, all of a sudden.
It's because it's been probably about 2 months since we did a podcast together. I'm trying to think what the last one was.
It's been quite a while.
We talked about commuting.
Yeah.
And I think there was a second half that I re-recorded or
put in another section. But you put it up, yeah, a lot later.
So really, it's been almost since we moved in, since we did one together. Because I think we only did one, but that ended up getting divided into two episodes. So I feel like we're never going to talk about Mount Fuji. Okay. I guess we should talk a little bit first about getting to Mount Fuji. Many people probably think that Mount Fuji is somewhere really far away in a very remote place.
Mm.
And others probably think that it's, you know, right outside of Tokyo because of the postcards and everything. I've actually seen many postcards that try to layer Mount Fuji behind Tokyo.
Oh, really?
To make it look like it's almost part of Tokyo. Mm. It's like they use Photoshop or something. Very weird. But no, Mount Fuji is probably only about a 2.5 hour bus ride from Tokyo. When we went, we took the Fuji Kyuko from Shinjuku.
Mm-hmm.
Did you end up taking the same?
We did. We reserved it, but we left late from here. So we missed our bus, but luckily they had one right after. I think like half an hour later.
Okay.
Yeah, it's the Fuji, what is it called?
Fuji Kyuko, KO. It's run by KO.
Yeah, I think must be the only one that goes.
Yeah, there's
the biggest one probably.
I think there's four approaches to Mount Fuji. There's four trails. Maybe we should start there. There's the Yoshida-Guchi trail, I think. The Tsubashiri trail, if I wrote these down correctly. The Fujinomiya trail and the Gotemba trail. And the Yoshida-Guchi trail is the one that's the most famous, and I believe that's the one we both took.
Mm.
And it basically starts at Kawaguchi Gogome, which is the fifth station. Now, there's actually, I think, two ways to climb Mount Fuji. They say that the real way is to start all the way at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially starting at the first station, which is quite a ways away. And I think taking that approach takes about 2 to 3 days in total. About a day and a half to go up and about a day and a half to go down. That's what I've been told. But in the interest of time, you can actually climb from the fifth stations.
Mm-hmm.
So the bus that we both took apparently starts at Kawaguchi Gogome, and Gogome is fifth station.
Right.
So you have, I think, approximately half the climb already done for you at that point.
The fifth station is how high? 1,000? It's over 1,000.
That's a really good question.
It's like 1,100.
Let me see if I can find that right now. Yeah, there are. Each one actually starts at a different altitude, too. But the Kawaguchiko fifth station is actually 2,300 meters.
Okay, yeah, that's like two thirds almost.
Yeah, the Mount Fuji itself is actually about 3,700 meters. Yeah. Let me see here, 3,776. So yeah, you're pretty, I mean, Tokyo is pretty much at sea level. So you're, like you said, you're probably two-thirds the way
up. Yeah, you're already up pretty high by the time you're at fifth station.
Yeah. Did you notice a big difference when you got off the bus?
I didn't really notice any of, like, altitude. It didn't really affect me.
I noticed something really strange.
Yeah?
Yeah. Like, if you put your tongue on the roof of your mouth and try to suck air through, you can't. Like, you can kind of make a vacuum in your mouth. When I did that up there, and don't ask me why I was doing this, it's just, right. I didn't realize it until it started happening, and then I tried it when I got back. I don't do this all the time. But I noticed that up there, it was easier for air to, like, squeeze in.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Wow. And I don't know if it was just because the air was that much thinner. They say at the top of Mount Fuji, so about 3,700 meters up, there's two-thirds the amount of oxygen that there would be otherwise. So, I mean, I guess that's a pretty big difference if you're not used to it. So there's also train routes that will go to different cities around Mount Fuji, which may be relatively cheaper, but they're more difficult because they do involve many transfers, and I think in order to get up to any fifth station, you end up having to take a bus anyway.
Right, because the buses stop at the first station or third. I think ours stopped at the third station.
Oh, yours did?
Yeah.
Ours was supposed to, but they just blew right by it.
Okay.
I think everybody wanted to go to the fifth. But yeah, you can take a bus to the lower stations, but I think if you're going to go, just grab a bus to Kawaguchi Gogoma. It's probably the best area to start from, and especially if you're coming from Tokyo, because you can leave right from Shinjuku.
Right, yeah, it's really quite convenient.
Yeah, it's right across the street from Yodobashi, kind of?
Yeah, there's a Yodobashi there.
Yeah. So go to the Yodobashi camera in Shinjuku and look across the street. That's where the KO bus station is. And I think you can call to reserve your tickets ahead of time. There was actually an English number available too, but they never picked up the phone.
Yeah, exactly. I tried it too.
You tried it too?
Yeah.
I must have tried that number 4 or 5 times at all different times during the day. And eventually I gave up and did the Japanese number. And I was able to book the tickets okay, so it wasn't too bad. It all worked out. So that's actually getting to Mount Fuji. And what time? We both went at night, but there's also an approach where you can do it during the day and get up and come back down during the day. But we chose to go at night, where the method is to arrive around, I think, around 8 or 9 in the evening, and to climb during the evening in the pitch black, and then watch the sunrise at the top. So we ended up doing we both ended up doing that route, but we ended up doing it on separate days. So just to clarify that for everybody, because we probably will have quite different stories. I went with my fiance Linda, and you went with...
Yeah, I went out with Sean, one of our classmates, and a friend of his from Shanghai. He's a Dutch MBA. His name was Jesse.
Oh, okay. So Alex went with Sean and Jesse. I went with Linda. So we went out separate times. And what were your impressions, first of all, when you got off the bus?
Well, we were a little bit lost, actually, when we first got off, because there were very few people there.
Oh, really?
At the fifth station. What time
did you arrive?
We got there around 10:30, 10:40.
Oh, wow. That's pretty late.
Yeah. So the majority of the climbers were already up. And we didn't see many people behind us when we were going up. Yeah, so at first we were a bit surprised because we heard, you know, there'd be a lot of tourists and stuff. But there really wasn't. It was really dark too, and we only had these little flashlights. And the part where you get off from the bus, there are actually no signs pointing you which way to go.
Yeah.
So we were walking in one direction for like 10 minutes before, you know, we got a little nervous and we asked one of the guys behind us, you know, are we going the right way? So, you know, eventually we found a big map and we were doing the right thing, but...
It's actually kind of weird because we had the exact same thing happen to us when we got off. We bought our walking sticks.
Right, yeah.
You got the walking sticks too. The walking sticks are kind of interesting. It's just this sort of, I think it's octagonal. I'm looking at it now. It looks like it's probably an octagon. It's cut in the shape of an octagon. And as you go to each station, they'll essentially burn or brand the stick with a little piece of metal that has a bunch of information about the station, the name, the year, and it looks like the kanji for the station and the altitude.
Yeah. Sometimes they have a little, I don't know, a little sign or a little figure on it, too.
Yeah. So everybody has these walking sticks, and our walking sticks had these bells.
Yeah, we had those, too.
They lasted all of about 20 minutes. Because you're using this stick, and you hear, you have this bell on your stick, and you feel like cattle. Like, I don't know about you guys, but I just felt like cattle. So eventually, bells are gone.
Yeah, I took mine off. You took yours immediately. Because it'd be, like, annoying.
That's probably...
hear that thing, like, clanging all the way up.
That's probably a good thing, because they were so annoying. Yeah. I tried to hold it at the top so they wouldn't rattle around as much, and eventually, you just pull them right off. So you had your Mount Fuji walking stick. We got ours as well. We kind of suited up and started walking in one direction. But when you walk in that direction, it actually goes down.
Yeah, exactly.
So we were thinking, we're actually walking down the mountain. And right when we arrived, it got foggy, and you couldn't see more than 10 feet in front of you either way.
Wow.
So we would see, like, flashlights coming towards us, and eventually we found a couple, and we asked them, is this the right way to go up the mountain? And they were like, yeah, you're going the right way.
Yeah, I was a little afraid that we didn't bring enough light, because at that point it's just us and it was really dark.
Was the moon in the sky at that point?
Not quite yet. But it was really dark, is all I remember. You couldn't see much more than a few feet in front of you.
Mm.
So we were kind of afraid, you know, we would have gone on the wrong path.
There's one part, too, when you come up to it, it actually splits. And you have to choose which way to go. Mm. It's kind of like a real-life version of a choose-your-own-adventure book. It's pretty surreal because it's nighttime. There's nobody around. Even when we left, there were many tourists at the fifth station. But when we left on our own. And there was no one in front of us and no one behind us.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we eventually took that right because the mountain is on your right side when you're walking that way and found our way up. Now, that first section of the climb from the fifth station to the sixth station is pretty easy.
It was interesting because, if I recall, it wasn't steps yet, right? It was kind of like a sandy...
It was like a sandy, path. Gravelly incline.
Yeah. I actually found it a little more difficult than the steps.
You did?
Yeah. Simply because, I guess, just the way your weight is balanced and distributed when you step.
Mm.
It's not that solid, you know, so...
Yeah, that's true.
Kind of push off a little bit more.
I was kind of excited during that first section, though, so...
Yeah, well, I was too. You know, I was still pumped at that point.
It was strange when we arrived and we got to the first switchback, and you could look up and see the incline of the mountain, like the silhouette of the mountain against the sky. Because when we arrived, we had the moon, and the moon was kind of lighting some of the sky behind the mountain. And you could see it was really faint, but it was so strange because it was faint.
Mm-hmm.
And very difficult to see, but it was so big. It was such a, like a, I don't know, oxymoron is the wrong word, but it was such a contrast to be barely able to see something, but to have it be so big. And because it was still foggy, we could see the lights from the sixth station creating like a halo
mm-hmm.
around. So we kind of knew how close we were during that first part. But you thought the first part was more difficult.
Well, like, eventually when we got to the stairs, I felt it's kind of a relief, actually.
Oh, okay.
Our night was actually pretty clear. It wasn't much fog at all.
Okay. So the first section from 5 to 6 was pretty easy, I think. It wasn't too bad. And from what I remember, there was quite a few people at the first station kind of hanging out.
I don't remember there being especially too crowded. I think at that point people weren't resting for very long, so they kept on moving after just a brief rest.
Yeah, we arrived at the fifth station around 7:30, I think 7:30, 8 o'clock. Mm-hmm. So we took many rests on the way up. But okay, let's talk about 6 to 7 because I think that for me that was probably the most boring
part. 6 to 7. Was this the part where you actually had to sort of actually climb?
No, I think that was more like 7 to 8.
Was it?
Yeah. We should probably describe for a second. There's nine stations, nine main stations, but there's huts all along the way.
Yeah, the problem is, like, you say there's a seventh station, but there's like a new seventh station, like an old seventh station. I was never really sure, like...
Was it a new eighth?
Yeah,
old something, eighth, new
something
eighth.
Like that.
It's really strange because there's probably, I guess the best way to describe it, from the fifth station to the top, there are maybe 20 huts going up that trail.
So it's really, you know, when I heard like an eighth station, I thought it would be just like one big like rest area. But yeah, like you're saying, there's like all these little huts on the way up.
It's like they decided one of the huts was going to be called the eighth station.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
I bet you could have gotten many more things on your stick because we didn't stop at every single one to get it branded.
Yeah, eventually we just stopped doing it because there's this, you know, I thought it was for one for each station, but just, you know, each hut had their own little
brand. Yeah. That's something to keep in mind too, to carefully pick. If you do plan on climbing, try to look at the map and see which ones are the actual official sixth station, seventh station, eighth station, new eighth station, mm-hmm. and then the ninth station, I think, is the top.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting because I kind of felt like I was in a video game. And I'm like, oh, I just got to get the next level. I just got to get to the next level. So I think my fiance had a little bit of trouble. She started getting a migraine on the way up, so we didn't think we were going to make it up all the way. But unfortunately, at that point, I stopped the recordings. So I don't have any recordings from it because I was just worried about her and trying to figure out what we're going to do. What's interesting, though, about the climb is there's only so many places where you can turn around. You can't just say, okay, I can't do it anymore, I need to turn around. Because the way the climb gets eventually is it gets to be fairly rocky and fairly, I don't know, there were some points where I think I even had to use my hands
to kind of
climb myself up. And once it starts getting crowded, there's no real way to just sort of turn around and come down. In fact, I don't think I saw anyone coming down when we were going. Maybe one or two sets of people.
No, not until we reached the top. I didn't see anyone turn around. I didn't pass anyone like coming down.
Yeah. I think to talk a little more or just to cap off the area between 6 and 7, what I remember is that was the area where there's lots of like switching back and forth. And the climb wasn't too difficult. It was more like steps, but not quite really rocky and jagged.
Yes, yes. There were, I remember now. There were walls.
Like on retaining the way up. Walls.
Yeah. At that point, I was feeling kind of tired already.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was pretty tired the whole way up, actually. But the walls were useful because it was kind of a way for me to kind of keep track of where I was going.
Mm. From what I remember, too, the climb between the 6th and the 7th took the longest. In terms of space between the huts. I think so. There's quite a few, there's quite a few huts on the way, but I think there was a gap between the official stations of about almost 2 hours.
I wasn't keeping track of which ones were official at that point, because it's a little confusing. But I remember there were, I think this was a stretch where there were quite a few huts, actually.
Mm-hmm. 7th to 8th. That was pretty intense. I think for me, 7th to 8th was my most tired moment.
It kind of woke me up, actually. Because if 7th to 8th was the steepest part where you actually had to kind of, scale rocks a little bit. And in a way, because, you have to pay more attention. You feel, maybe it's a little more dangerous as well.
7th to 8th, well, it's kind of a tie between 7th to 8th and 8th to 9th, but 7th to 8th kind of struck me as the most dangerous because of the wind at the time. There was, you do these switchbacks, and on the right side it was really windy, and on the left side there was barely any wind. It's like the way the wind was coming over the mountain at that time. But yeah, that was mostly like, it got to a point, I think, where it was really difficult to even see where the path was. They drilled these holes into these rocks and put these poles in and run ropes through them. But I literally ran into a few of those poles because I couldn't see them.
Yeah, we were just, for some parts, we're just pulling ourselves up just along the chains.
Oh, really? So you're using the chains to pull yourself up?
Just to see where the path was. Because otherwise, you can't really tell.
Now, I think there's different ways to go about it with all the groups, because once you get past the 7th station, there's quite a few people. There's, I would say, maybe at least 2 or 3 groups that would come through every station every 10 minutes. And the groups have a group leader with like a big... I mean, these guys have like almost like sirens on their heads, it seems like. Like lots of blinking lights.
Yeah, this dude had like a backpack with like lights on it.
Like, and the big, traffic control cones that light up and you can hold them. And they usually put one person in the middle if it's a big group and then one person at the end. So if you get stuck in one of these groups, the good thing is the groups are paced so that everybody can go. And you get to walk along with the group as if you're part of the group. But the bad thing is if you're at the back end of a group, you basically, there's no way for you to pass a group.
Yeah, it got a little tough, but I noticed the biggest group we had there was, I think, a big Chinese tour group. And they would stop, though, just to collect all their members. In a way, they step to the side and let people pass them while they're waiting. So it wasn't too bad from 7th to 8th for us, I don't think.
The final ascent, well, we had stopped at 8th, and we left. We stayed there for maybe about an hour and a half, which in retrospect, I think for us was a bad idea because I was wearing multiple layers, but it was so sweaty, even mm-hmm. with those layers, that as soon as I took my backpack off, I was cold because the wind would blow across my back, and it was so humid and moist that it wouldn't dry, mm-hmm. but just stay wet and cold. So it's pretty terrible. That hour and a half kind of sucked, to put it bluntly. But after that, going from 8th to the top, we just sort of paced ourselves, and I think that was probably the second easiest from, you really? Know, the first easiest being that first part. Yeah,
for me the final ascent had to be the toughest part.
Really?
I mean, for one thing, it was freezing,
and yeah, it is pretty cold.
And I didn't have a scarf. And that's the thing I actually wish I brought the most. Because the wind would blow across your face.
Yeah.
And that was pretty tough on me. I think, you know, combined with the sweat and everything. So my face was getting really cold. And at this point, I was really sleepy, too. Because, I don't know, it was about, for us, it was about 3, or like 2, 3 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
by the time we were up on the final ascent. And this was the part where it got really crowded. The climb, it really, really slowed down. I mean, I was really surprised at how slow people were going. You know, you just have to stand in place basically for a few minutes, take a few steps and wait again. So, you know, you're standing there and you're cold and you're not moving. You know, you're really tired.
And the wind's blowing over you. And
you know, you really feel like just, you know, sitting down, like taking a nap or something. So this was hard, you know, to keep motivated, to keep going at this point.
Yeah.
And I was separated from Sean and Jesse.
Oh, you were?
Yeah. Jesse was, he was like way ahead. And Sean, at this point, he was, the climb was a little tough for him because the altitude was affecting him. He had bought the oxygen by this time. So he was way in the back somewhere. So I was kind of in between the two guys, you know.
Mm.
So, you know, you're kind of...
Kind of by yourself.
Right, you got no one, you know, to talk to keep you awake, you know. So this part was the hardest for me, actually.
Wow. We left the 8th station around 1:30 in the morning. And we gave ourselves about 2 hours to get up to the top, and I think we actually arrived an hour and a half. It's the shortest part, but you're right, there's so many people there and you have to wait. Mm. Even at 1:30, we didn't arrive until about 3 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. But the downside to that was you're waiting on top of the mountain,
yeah,
in the cold,
exactly.
Doing nothing, waiting for the sunrise. So yeah, now did you stop at any of the stores at the top there?
We stopped at From the final station up, no, I don't think so.
There's like ramen shops. There's some gift shops. And if San's listening, I know he is because he probably saw the title on the cast and is listening to it right now, but there were actually vending machines on the top of Mount Fuji.
Oh, you mean at the very top?
Yeah, at the very top.
We bought a couple hot drinks, but that was it.
I was torn between getting coffee from the vending machine, mm. but I think if I recall correctly, the vending machines were just out of control expensive.
Really?
It was probably 600 or 700 yen,
really?
For a small Boss coffee can.
Oh. I think we paid like maybe 300, 400 for like from one of the stores for a can of like hot chocolate. Yeah.
Yeah. They had these guys with buckets filled with water,
yeah.
on stoves, heating them up and boiling the water, and they had all the cans mm-hmm. of coffee in the buckets,
yeah.
to keep them warm.
That's where we got it from.
We stopped and got ramen, too. And it was such an interesting store because the store kitchen was in the back.
Mm-hmm.
There were no tables, just rows of seats. So people would sit down and kind of huddle together
mm-hmm.
and eat the ramen and just sort of warm up before... heading off. Now, at the top of Mount Fuji, you actually come up on one edge of the crater.
Yeah.
And there's a trail that goes all the way around the crater. And when you climb up on the Kawaguchi Go side, you don't actually reach the summit because there's an area that has a weather observatory station that is actually the summit. Did you guys get a chance to walk around the top?
We went towards the crater, but we didn't circle around it. So I don't think we actually went to the, you know, the highest point possible. But we did walk a bit on our side. Crater there. Just looking around.
So now when you guys didn't quite arrive at the top by the time the sun rose, but that didn't affect you
sunrise, did it? No, we were probably, I would say, 10 minutes away from the top. But, you know, simply because of the crowds, we just decided just to stop on the way up instead. We had a pretty good view, though. It was quite unobscured. Yeah. And it's, you know, just right in front of where the sun came up. So we just sat there. I think it must have been almost 4:30, 4:40 about. And we just waited for the sunrise. And then after it had come up, then we continued on our way to the top.
Okay. And it only took you about 10 minutes to get up to the top.
Yeah.
From that point on.
Yeah. Because at that point, you know, the path was relatively flowing. Because, you know, when we sat down, people were still trying to make it to the top. But we just decided we weren't going to make it. But actually, we probably would have if we did it. But, you know, we had a really good view anyways, so.
And what did you think of the sunrise? Do you think it was worth it from the top?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, at that point, I was pretty miserable, you know. You, like, crouch on these rocks and it's windy. But, you know, when the sun comes up, it's quite an amazing view. Because all of a sudden, you know, because you can see the lakes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't see it at all in the night. And all of a sudden, you could see all these lakes and, you know, all this greenery just popping up in front of you.
We had a slightly different experience because when we climbed it, it was fairly cloudy. And while we were waiting for the sun to rise, you know, the sky starts to open up and mm-hmm. the sky starts getting lighter. But it was still very windy. And there was a pretty strong wind coming over the backside of the mountain down over the top. And there were these clouds that were coming over, flying, had to be maybe 20 meters over our heads and then down the mountain.
Wow.
It was really cool. But when the sun rose, we couldn't see anything except down the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
Because everything else was clouds. So we got the sunrise like up through the clouds and everything below was white.
Really?
Yeah. For at least, I don't know, maybe about the next hour or so until the sun started burning off the clouds. But yeah, we couldn't see any of the lakes or any of that until we started actually going down on the descent. So let's talk about the descent for a little bit. It sort of sounds anticlimactic.
Yeah, you know? I know.
Like, yeah, we made it to the top, yeah. I mean, I guess to summarize, at this point, yeah, we were both pretty excited that we made it to the top. None of us really got hit with the altitude too bad. No. I think, you know, everything I had read said that you need to dress really warmly, which is true. I mean, I think protecting your hands and feet is probably the biggest thing, and then your face.
Yeah.
But they said it's, like, really dangerous, and the altitude sickness is a real problem, but I really didn't see much of that. I didn't see many people that were sick or had issues.
They had the little, I don't know what you call it. It's like it's a little cart, but it runs on like a treads, like a tank or something.
Mm-hmm.
And that did pass us on our descent though. I think like twice. So some people did get sick, but I think that was already by the time they made it to the top.
Mm-hmm.
So.
But overall, I didn't think it was, I mean, I didn't train to climb Mount Fuji.
Yeah.
It's definitely doable if you're just a common, you know, person. If you're in reasonably good shape, like you can walk to work if you had to, you know, then you're fine. I think you can climb Mount Fuji.
Yeah, I mean, it's not such a physically strenuous climb. I mean, it is tiring, but, you know,
it's more of a mental thing in my
mind. I think so, you know, because at that point, combined with, you know, being cold and being tired, you know, yeah, that makes it a lot tougher.
Especially if you do it overnight, because you have the whole tiredness thing to deal with. And it was strange because I really didn't feel that tired when I was climbing, but I think Linda was pretty beat. And you said you were pretty tired.
Yeah, too. I was ready to sleep on that final ascent.
I was nowhere near ready to go to sleep by the time. But yeah, I think climbing up is pretty doable, but climbing down is terrible. I think that was the worst part of climbing Mount Fuji, was going down.
I'd have to agree there.
Going down Mount Fuji is pretty much hell. It is really terrible. It looks like hell. It feels like hell. And by the time you get halfway down, you just want to die and kill yourself. It's pretty bad.
It's surprising because when you look down, at first I thought it was just a straight ascent, you know, a straight path down, but it's like zigzags the whole way down.
Mm-hmm. And it's gravel. It's not even gravel. It's like fine sand that you're going down. So if you're wearing any type of shoe that lets air in, you're essentially going to have, you know, black feet by the time you get down.
Yeah.
How long did it take you guys to get down?
You know, it's funny because I think all most guides and stuff say it takes like, what, 2 hours? 2-3 hours? But it took us four and a half, almost five, to get all the way back to the fifth station.
We decided to go to a different fifth station on the way down. So it was one of those stations that says it. If you climb from that station, it's supposed to take 6 to 8 hours to get up, mm-hmm. and about half that, so 3 to 4 hours to get down. It took us about 4.5 hours to get down. And there was one section of the trail where they had literally, it looked like they just like plowed down the mountain and put rope up on either side. And that the trail down for a good 2 kilometers straight down, just shooting down the mountain. And eventually we developed this walking technique where we go heel first, and it's kind of like a hopping jog. And you're able to dig your heels into the sand and let it slide a little bit as you pull your other foot out, and then keep repeating the process going all the way down. But every once in a while, you hit like a really loose part and land on your ass. It was really fun.
Yeah, that was the worst part, was that it's just so slippery.
Yeah.
Because of all the gravel. And you'd have to go slowly, otherwise you just topple over on your face, unless you're leaning back the whole time.
And I think if there's any part of training that I wish I did before doing the whole up and down of Mount Fuji, I wish I had trained my quads and the bottom part of my quad that connects to my knee, because that is the part that I think gets hit most when you're coming down the mountain, because you're constantly trying to prevent yourself from going too fast. Mm. So you're using these muscles to slow yourself down. And after, you know, I can get on like a stair mill or whatever it is, or a bicycle, and ride really hard and exercise really well for a good 30 minutes. But this was doing it for about a good 3.5 hours.
Yeah.
And eventually you get to a point where you're like, I don't want to do this anymore.
Yeah.
But unlike going up, there's no option to turn around.
Right. And there are no huts or anything to rest at
right.
on the way down.
Right. So you're basically stuck in a situation where you have to do it.
Right.
And the only question is if you take your time, it's just going to take longer and you're going to extend the pain.
We were trying to get down faster, too, because it's beginning to get really hot on the way down. I don't know how it was for you guys, but
it was pretty terrible.
Yeah, the sun was coming up pretty soon, so that's why we didn't want to stay at the top too long. And it was getting pretty hot.
Yeah, we actually got sunburned.
Really?
When we were there, yeah. And we were covered in about a good, you know, 2 or 3 millimeters of dirt.
Right. Yeah.
And you're coming down. You're sweating. You're tired. You're hurting. It's a terrible experience. We were saying they should just put a ski lift on Mount Fuji.
Yeah, I know exactly. I mean, you think with the, I don't know how many people go every year, but
they get rid of the line problem.
Yeah. And it's probably a little dangerous too, especially for like older people when they're coming down.
You know,
that's you saw quite a few older people like fall down, but
yeah, they get back up. They get back up. That's one of the things we didn't talk about, but we're running at about 50 minutes now already. But the people who are climbing Mount Fuji, we saw everything from, I don't know, I have to say, a 6-year-old all the way up to 70-80-year-olds.
Yeah,
it was really incredible. I think unlike some other places I've seen in the U.S. where the hike may be a little treacherous, like maybe Yellowstone. I've never been there, but I've seen pictures. But certainly places like Mount Washington, the Rocky Mountains I've been to, you don't tend to see many young people or many older people in those types of situations.
Right.
But at Mount Fuji, I would have to say the majority of the people there actually had to be at least 50 years old. There were many, many people who looked like they were retired, who were climbing Mount Fuji with their wives or their husbands.
Mm-hmm, yeah. That was my experience, too. You see a lot of older people going up.
We went on a Friday night, So many of the people who were there, I think, were still in the workforce.
Mm-hmm.
But you guys went up on a Wednesday.
Yeah, we went up on Wednesday.
And did you notice that there were more younger people than older people, or more foreigners than Japanese?
Not particularly. In the bus that we went, I think I would say the majority were foreigners. But on the climb up, I couldn't really tell.
This is maybe 95% of the people who climbed Mount Fuji were from Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And many, maybe about a third of those were from China. Mm-hmm. And the rest, I'd say, were either a mix of Japanese, Korean, and maybe a few Korean. There were actually a few Korean groups and maybe a few like Taiwanese, mm-hmm. or South Asia, like Philippines. But yeah, it was mostly Asian people, which was surprising because I haven't met, in my circle of friends and colleagues and coworkers, I haven't met anybody else who's climbed Mount Fuji.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if you read this when you're looking up stuff on Mount Fuji, but like a statistic they like to throw around is like, you say, like 1% of the population in Japan is, that's the only, that have climbed it.
It's like, so it's 1%. Like 130 million people in Japan. Right. And so 1.3 million people have,
right, of Japanese climbed
Mount Fuji. But there's, it says, like, I read something somewhere where they say, you know, there's tens of thousands of people that do it every year.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just incredible.
Well, it's funny because I was talking to some of my English students and they're saying, yeah, you know, Mount Fuji is something that, like, foreigners like to do a lot, but not so much, you know, Japanese people.
I wonder why that is. Yeah. Do you think it's because they take it for granted, or they're just, they grow up with it in their backyard, so it never occurs to them to go climb up it?
It could be, but, you know, talking to them, they're, none of them showed too much of a great desire to climb.
It was interesting. I had a coworker. I still do have a coworker, but my coworker was listening to me telling him about, mm-hmm. how I wanted to climb Mount Fuji. And after I came back, him and his family had decided to go.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Because
he said it was something he always wanted to do, but it never occurred to him to do it with his family. And he did it with his family, but I think his wife turned around at the 6th station, and him and his daughter turned around at the 7th.
Oh, wow.
So but they tried to do it during the day, and they didn't make it up to the top. I don't think I could have climbed Mount Fuji during the day because of the heat. I think I would much prefer to do it at night and then come down during the day.
Yeah, I definitely would have gone during the night. Because, I mean, at that time, it was really hot during the day.
Yeah, it's very hot. I mean, considering July and August are probably the two hottest months of the year for Japan, you really need to take that into consideration. It's not so hot at the top, but you're right. As you come down, it gets gradually hotter and hotter. Mm. And I imagine when you're climbing up the mountain, as the day goes on, you don't notice it getting cooler and cooler because the air is compensating for that. Yeah. So, well, I think that pretty much summarizes it. We're kind of killing this here, but I don't know. What else?
One thing I kind of want to ask you is, like, what made you want to climb it in the first place?
Well, I mean, there's only so many things that are famous in Japan, mm-hmm. and I wanted to do as many of them as possible. And I think that after living in Japan for a year and a half, if I hadn't climbed it,
mm-hmm.
to me it would have been a wasted opportunity. Because there are people who will come out here just to do that.
That's true.
But we're here, and we should be taking advantage of these things. I think there's many things like that, like going to Okinawa,
right.
which you just came back from. We want to ask you about that in another show. Uh-huh. I have to write all these things down. You know, going up north to Sapporo and seeing the ice festivals and things like that, or going to Hiroshima.
Mm.
I mean, these are experiences that, to me, are world experiences, not just being in Japan. Mm-hmm. So, you know, might as well do them while you're here. What about yourself?
Well, I didn't really think too much about it, but, like, after you came back, after hearing what, you know, your stories about it, that really made me want to go. And it's really good timing that, you know, Sean and Jesse came. Did, but I'd have to agree with you about the part about it being not just a Japanese experience but a world experience, you know, something that, I don't know, it's like a really unique and, you know, special opportunity to do this. So, yeah,
I think too, as I get older, I need to keep challenging myself, and it's definitely, when we had started the climb, I wasn't sure if I would be able to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was more of a mental challenge, like we said, to see if we could actually do it. And I'm glad we did. It was definitely worth it. I don't think I will ever do it again. They say there's a saying that says a man who climbs Mount Fuji once is very wise, but only a fool will climb it twice. Right. I don't know. I have to agree with that. What do you think?
Yeah, pretty much. The funny thing is, though, at the fifth station, we're talking to this Japanese guy, and it was his third time going up.
And he wasn't a tourist.
No. No,
he wasn't. That has to make you wonder.
Yeah. And he was going up during the day, too.
Maybe it flips over if you do it one more time.
Yeah, after the third time,
but it reverses. I think I could physically do it a second time, mm-hmm. but I don't think I would want to do it a second time. So there you go. If you guys are interested in climbing Mount Fuji, hopefully we gave you some good information. I guess to summarize is take the bus because it's the easiest way, and you can do a return trip. Go at night, but dress warm and bring some hand and head protection.
Yeah.
And then if there's anything you do ahead of time, try to train your legs a little bit for the descent because that seems to be much more difficult than the actual ascent up the mountain, unfortunately. Okay, I'm going to see if I can actually do this without killing everything here. Probably not. Looks like it's not working right now. So I'll do the outro in post-production. It's running right now. But Alex, thanks again for taking the time to do this. And to the listeners, I hope you enjoyed it. There was one clip in there of me sort of reporting on the beginning of the climb, but like I said, we had to not really pay too much attention to the doing podcasting, 12,000 feet up in the air. Or high. I never calculated how high that up was in feet for our U.S. listeners. Let me do that really quick here. So it's 3,776 feet, and that's going to be a length conversion. And that is meters to feet. That's over 12,000 feet up. So that's pretty high.
Yeah.
So, excuse me for not taking some audio up there. But again, I hope this sort of experience makes up for it. And if you do come to Japan, please, and if you're at all interested in climbing Mount Fuji, definitely climb it. It'd be insane.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you guys real soon. Bye.